Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, helping businesses to hire workers with disabilities. Information about the benefits of hiring people with a wide range of disabilities is available at abletrust.org or 850-224-4493. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Florida's long battle to adopt a new congressional district map that will pass judicial muster continues.
It just makes it a little longer, but it is kind of pleasurable to watch the House and Senate fuss with each other.
Also this week, how high is too high when it comes to setting test performance measures for Florida school kids?
Shame on us if Florida were to end up with a lower bar than our neighboring states, Alabama and Georgia.
We'll also look at possible changes to the state's controversial Stand Your Ground law and dish up a heaping plate of fresh fruits and veggies from one of Florida's growing crop of farmers markets. I'm Tom Flanagan. Welcome to Capitol Report. On Capitol Report, Nick Evans is with us, and the action as far as congressional redistricting moved from the Capitol to the courtroom this week as Leon Circuit Judge Terry Lewis was jumping into a series of hearings about these revised districts, what they should look like, will they pass muster with the Supreme Court. And this particular go-around, Nick, the battle lines seem to be a little bit different than what they have been. What happened there?
I guess first what we should talk about is just how pivotal this is. So the way that the Supreme Court has changed its order after the legislature failed to redraw maps is that Terry Lewis now has to recommend to them what they should approve. Now, the House and Senate have been at odds all year long. It broke down the regular session. It broke down the special session. We're seeing more of the same. Really, a fight over Medicaid and the budget has infected an existing fight over congressional districts. When we had a special session in 2014 to redraw lines, it was over and done with in maybe 3 days. So this fight is splintering into different factions. The other thing that's not helping out here is the Senate reached a settlement with the League of Women Voters over what should happen with the Senate districts, and that means that they're going to have a further special session in October. The House is very unhappy about this because the House really wasn't kept in the loop for that settlement. All of this means, though, that the lawyers for the plaintiffs, folks like David King, who's representing the League of Women Voters, they're just tickled.
It just makes it a little longer, but it is kind of pleasurable to watch the House and Senate fuss with each other.
Well, with so many bones of contention to choose from then, Nick, what's the primary sticking point at this point?
Well, you know, that's a little bit different too. Throughout most of this fight, we've been talking about District 5, which under an old enacted plan was sort of this strange snaking contraption that went from Jacksonville down toward Orlando. And because of that, because that was the center of debate, most of the district lines that were that people were at odds over were in North and Central Florida. Because of the way that the legislature's base maps and then revisions to that base map were drawn, that really isn't the focus of debate any longer. Instead, it shifted to the Miami area in districts 26 and 27. So the way that this works out is the state Supreme Court ordered the legislature to redraw 26 and 27 because they split Homestead. The justices said that the legislature split the city to benefit Republicans. So they moved the entirety of the city into District 26. And what the League of Women Voters is saying is that the way that you did that actually still benefits Republicans. But the House and Senate staffers that were in charge of drawing the base map defended their actions. They said, we knew that we had to keep Homestead whole, so we tried it once with Homestead in 26 and once with Homestead in 27.
After we determined that both drafts would perform, at that point, either option is kind of a tomato-tomato situation. So we decided to look at the compactness scores for all of those districts.
So, Nick, what's next? Where do we go from here?
Well, as I said, this is going to be 3 days worth of hearings. We're just wrapping up day two today, and we're going to meet again on Monday to speak further about this. From there, Judge Lewis will have to decide on what to recommend to the state Supreme Court. And actually, on Thursday, in the midst of hearings, he let slip something that could throw a bit of a monkey wrench into this.
Good, but here I've got your maps, as well as the Senate map and the House map, to say to the Supreme Court, I think you should choose this or this combination thereof because of X, Y, and Z.
So, I don't know if you caught that, but what Judge Lewis just suggested is that of the 7 maps that have been submitted to him, he might not just say, here's map number 4 or here's map number 6. Instead, he may take parts of different maps and put them together and suggest to the Supremes, this is what I want you to do. It's a mix of a little bit of what the House did here, a little bit of what the Senate did here. And oh, by the way, here's something that the Remo plaintiffs did that I like too. So we really are again, in uncharted territory with this. And it's going to be very interesting to see what he decides on. He's got a deadline of October 17th. That's when the state Supreme Court wants to have his recommendation. And then after that, we should expect this to probably move forward pretty quickly after the end of hearings, because we've already heard from supervisors of elections saying that they need a map in place by December 1st. The primary is supposed to happen on March 15th, and they're saying that between the ballots they have to send to people that are overseas, either as expats or people in the military, they are really pressed for time for everyone to be able to participate by March 15th.
Watch this space. The line drawing continues, and we'll be right on top of it. Florida Public Radio's Nick Evans. Thanks, Nick.
Absolutely. Anytime.
Florida's Board of Education wants to set a high bar for student performance on the state's new standardized test. But as Lynn Hatter reports, some are questioning how high is too high.
The cut score is the number of questions a student has to get right in order to get a passing score. It's also used to group students and identify high and low achievers. The cut score is the number parents get when they receive their child's test results, and it determines whether a child is promoted or graduates. So setting that cut score is a big deal. Some Florida Board of Education members think recommendations from a review panel are too low.
Shame on us if Florida were to end up with a lower bar than our neighboring states, Alabama and Georgia.
State Board of Education member John Padgett believes the cut scores should be higher. He wants them to align with a test known as the National Assessment of Educational Progress, or NAEP. Students in most states take the NAEP, and there's historically been a performance gap. One test says a student is achieving, but another says they aren't. Patricia Levesque.
We say 60% of our fourth graders are reading proficiently, but on the NAEP test, only 39% score proficient in fourth grade reading. And so that gap means that we are likely telling about 20% of our parents, your child is doing just fine, when in reality, the child may not be and needs more support, needs more resources, and needs more help. And so our position is Florida needs to set honest cut scores on the new state test.
Levesque heads the Foundation for Florida's Future, which is pushing the state to raise the cut scores to NAEP levels. The point, Levesque says, is so that students and parents can accurately measure their performance.
When you set high expectations for your children, you get more, right? You expect more, you get more. The real issue we want to occur in Florida is to actually have honest cut scores. And so we want to make sure parents know when they get their child's score that this is really meaningful, that it's honest.
Other states have raised the cut scores to align with the national test. But there's a risk to that, says Paul Cottle, an FSU physics professor who has served on prior state exam review boards. He describes what happened in New York when the passing score on its exams went up.
Those passing rates were so low, and the way the tests were graded was so severe that parents and students and teachers and the policymakers just threw up their hands and said, we can't keep doing this. We have to change what we're doing. We have to back off. And in Florida, we can't afford to give up on this program.
Cottle says cut score setting is an art rather than a science. The scores reflect a value. They should be set high enough to make students, teachers, and parents want to perform better, but they shouldn't be unreachable. Florida's new exam is aligned with its new school learning standards, a transition the state is still getting used to. The standards are harder, and Cottle says that's one reason he believes there's been so much blowback on the new standards and the new exams.
It's a real challenge for the parents to swallow the fact that the math they knew, their level of math competence, just isn't good enough anymore. That's hard for a parent to accept. How many times have you heard a parent say, "But I was good enough in math. Why are you insisting that my child be better?" Well, we're insisting that their child be better because it just takes better math skills to be competitive in the world of 2015 than it was in the world of 1975.
The Florida Standards Assessment has been under fire from the start. It was put together hastily when Florida dropped the test it previously adopted. Students took the exam earlier this year and were greeted by technical failures and software problems. Some questions didn't align to the standards being taught in the classroom. Through it all, the test has been validated, but that hasn't stopped the questions. Florida schools will get graded based largely on those cut scores, and teachers will be evaluated on them as well. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Still to come on Capitol Report, bills dealing with Florida's Stand Your Ground and 1020 life laws have been filed for 2016, leaving some prosecutors none too happy.
These two bill shifting the burden and Stand Your Ground is not a wise idea. Neither is giving the judge the discretion to impose a lesser sentence.
And lawmakers working to fight food deserts say there could be a side benefit for small businesses.
So there's a financial incentive there for entrepreneurs to tap into.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by CGI, a partner to government and industry delivering built-for-government information technology solutions for nearly 40 years. CGI, committed to providing IT results Florida can count on. Details on the web at cgi.com.
Well, every July 1st or thereabouts, you hear all kinds of stories about new Florida laws taking effect based on what happened during the last legislative session. That's when most new laws go into effect, but there are some that hold off until the 1st of October. So this coming Thursday, it will be illegal to post sexually explicit material without the knowledge of people identified in the images. There will also be tougher criminal penalties imposed for convicted sex traffickers, and here are a few more of the 27 new laws going into effect in Florida October 1st. A new law makes clear that when a judge imposes a no-contact condition as part of a person's pretrial release in domestic violence cases, the order is effective immediately and enforceable for the duration of pretrial release. Here's another, a law that will allow golf carts to be driven on two-lane county roads if approved by municipalities. It will also require an 18-inch square red flag on all loads that jet out more than 4 feet from the back of vehicles. It will increase the fine from $100 to $500 for a violation of unlawfully displaying vehicles for sale, hire, or rental, and will also let certified emergency medical technicians with proper training administer emergency allergy treatment. Another new law makes it a second-degree misdemeanor for a person to install a tracking device or tracking application on another person's property without that other person's consent. The measure, though, doesn't apply to law enforcement officers during investigation or the parents or guardians of minors or caregivers of certain elderly or disabled adults. And then there's the one requiring judges to order public officials to make restitution and perform 250 hours of community service when found misusing their positions. Some Florida lawmakers are hoping to revive an effort that could change the role of state attorneys prosecuting a Stand Your Ground case. And as Sasha Cordner reports, some prosecutors are also against another bill giving judges more discretion in handing out mandatory 10-20 life sentences.
Last year, a bipartisan bill died in the legislature that would have made tweaks to Florida's Stand Your Ground law. Included in the measure was changing the role of a prosecutor during a pretrial hearing when a self-defense claim is made. Usually, a person claiming self-defense must go before a judge to prove the claim is justified. Now, a new bill by Ocala Republican Representative Dennis Baxley shifts that burden onto the prosecutors. He also helped write Stand Your Ground 10 years ago.
One of my concerns is the number of people that are pleading to lesser charges simply because they can't take the risk of going in front of a jury with a 20-year possibility of jail time. So many people that were exercising self-defense wind up making pleadings, which they shouldn't be put in that corner.
His bill comes on the heels of a recent ruling by the Florida Supreme Court that states shifting the burden would require prosecutors to prove their case twice.
I think we need to provide legislative clarity that we fully intend to stand with a person who's exercising self-defense, and that the burden of proof should be with the state attorney. You know, in this country, you're innocent until proven guilty, particularly when we have passed legislation to give you that presumption in your favor.
But Gainesville State Attorney Bill Cervone disagrees. He represents the Florida Prosecuting Attorneys Association on a number of legislative issues.
Our position on the law as it exists now has always been that this is an affirmative defense, which under law is something that is a matter for the defense to raise, and that the Supreme Court recently ruled that that was a proper interpretation of the statute, and we think that that's the way it should be.
Still, National Rifle Association's Marion Hammer says she disagrees with the majority opinion, saying the current system wasn't always that way.
Following passage of the Castle Doctrine law, prosecutors and some judges created, without any legislative authority, a special Stand Your Ground hearing and reversed the burden of proof, requiring an individual who has exercised lawful self-defense to prove before a judge that he or she was innocent. That flies in the face of our judicial system.
Both Baxley and Hammer agree with the dissenting opinion by Justices Charles Kennedy and Ricky Polston. It states making someone prove the claim during the immunity hearing, quote, curtails the benefit of the immunity from trial.
Well, you just need to remember the dissenting opinion is the side that lost, and so that's probably not the best approach to do legislation. Let's see what the loser said and follow it. But that would not be untypical of our government.
That's Tallahassee State Attorney Willie Meggs, who's opposed to Stand Your Ground and is also an opponent of Baxley's bill. He's also against a bill by Polk City Republican Representative Neil Cumby that gives judges discretion when it comes to handing out the mandatory 10-20 life law.
Well, there's a lot wrong with that bill. First off, if you have a mandatory 10-20 life that is not mandatory, then you need that's kind of a contradiction in itself.
Cumby calls it the Self-Defense Protection Act. He says it builds on the so-called warning shot bill he filed for the 2014 session seeking to address the unintended consequences of the 10-20 life law. It's inspired by Marissa Alexander, a Jacksonville woman who received a 20-year prison sentence for firing a warning shot during an alleged domestic violence dispute with her husband.
Unfortunately, you get into situations where folks who are unwilling to accept the plea deal are subject to the mandatory minimum of 20 years. And judges have, I would say they've complained about not having any choice but to impose that sentence. And they're really not imposing it. It's imposed by statute right now.
But Meg says it's not needed because prosecutors are already making decisions based on whether they want to depart from the 10-20 life law because they've investigated the case. He adds judges only have a partial view of an entire trial.
First off, a judge, number one, cannot even sit on a case where the judge has gone out and interviewed the witnesses, gone out and interviewed the victim of the crime, gone out and done an investigation. So the person in the courtroom that has the least knowledge about the case to decide what to do on the sentence is the judge, because they've interviewed no one. If they interview anybody, now if a judge doesn't want to impose a sentence, move over to civil, where they don't have to do the hard task of being a criminal judge.
Meanwhile, Cumby says he worked with families against mandatory minimums on this bill. And while the measure wasn't brought forth by the NRA, Hammer says she intends to support it. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kortner.
Eleven Florida and national animal protection and environmental groups jointly filed a friend of the court brief today that sides with a Seminole County organization that's trying to block the state's upcoming bear hunting season. Come Thursday of next week, Leon County Circuit Judge George Reynolds III will hear a legal challenge by Speak Up Wakaiva to the hunt, which was approved by the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. The season's scheduled to begin October 24th and last 2 to 7 days. It's the first bear hunt in the state in more than 2 decades. The state agency's goal is to reduce the bear population in Florida by 320, and as of this morning, 2,279 bear hunting permits had been purchased. The groups backing Speak Up Wakaiva were the Animal Legal Defense Fund, Animal Hero Kids, the Animal Rights Foundation of Florida, the Animal Welfare Institute, the Center for Biological Diversity, Compassion Works International, Environmental Action, the Jungle Friends, Primate Sanctuary, Lobby for Animals, the South Florida Wildlands Association, and Stop the Florida Bear Hunt. You're listening to Capitol Report on Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Florida Republicans have approved a new rule laying out requirements for GOP presidential candidates to appear on next year's presidential primary ballot. The rule, okayed by the Republican Party of Florida's executive board in a 35-1 vote early today, would give candidates 3 options if they want to take part in the state's winner-take-all GOP primary in March. Under the new rule, candidates can show up at the state's party's Sunshine Summit in November, pay a $25,000 fee before November 23rd, or gather petition signatures from just over 3,000 registered Republican voters. That would include at least 125 registered Republicans from each of the state's 27 congressional districts, wherever they may wind up being. State Chairman Blaise Ingoglia originally wanted to require all the GOP candidates to attend the fall feet to have their names on the ballot, but Ingoglia's proposal drew harsh criticism from many of his Republican colleagues. The modified rule, which was floated a day before today's executive board vote, in Ingoglia's words, gives clear options to candidates while empowering the grassroots of our great party. Finally tonight, Florida is known for its fresh fruits and veggies, but while it may seem to some they're in abundance, others have trouble accessing them. Regan McCarthy reports lawmakers are pushing legislation they hope will help.
It's Saturday morning, and despite the rain, a handful of merchants chats and bobs to the music at the Frenchtown Heritage Market in Tallahassee. The market has a central location where people using food stamps, now called SNAP benefits, can cash those in for brightly colored plastic tokens to spend on produce. Jim Bellamy heads up the market. He says it's a pretty simple process.
Come on, I'm going to show you. Show you more than I can tell you. That'll work better. Darcy, come a minute and tell this lady what you're doing.
At the market's center table, Darcy Washington is waiting with a silver cash box.
Say if you want $10 in tokens and you want to buy fruits and vegetables, we actually give you 20, so we double what you get. So we just you come up and you just swipe your card down and put in your PIN number. We put in $10. So we give you 10, and then we give you an extra 10, so you get 20, and they don't expire.
The Frenchtown Heritage Market is part of a program that lets Snap users stretch their dollar by doubling the amount they can spend at markets. So under Washington's example, someone who wants to spend 10 of their Snap dollars would get $20 in buying power. Bellamy says it's a great way to support members of the community who struggle to access fresh fruits and vegetables. And it also helps support the growers in the community by increasing the amount of food people can buy. But despite the deal, Bellamy says attendance at the market isn't growing as quickly as one might hope.
Not yet. For several reasons. One is a lot of people don't know about it. The other thing is that this whole process is something that's new to people, especially in this area. I mean, if you live in somewhere like New York, D.C., people go to the market. People here don't go to the market like that. You know what I'm saying?
Jacksonville Representative Reggie Fullwood has a bill he hopes will help with that by making it even more common to see food stamps or EBT cards accepted at farmers markets.
And this kind of sets the framework to make it an easier process. And again, some farmers markets are using allow it and some don't. Now, hopefully this bill will basically set the framework to say all farmers markets have the ability to do it.
Fullwood says the goal is to encourage healthier eating habits.
You know, one of the challenges that we see when in a lot of low income communities, is that there is these food deserts or a lack of fresh vegetables and healthy items in the stores. Oftentimes, folks are shopping at convenience stores or Family Dollar type stores, or just stores that don't have a wide variety of fresh foods that can contribute to healthy eating.
And Fullwood isn't the only lawmaker with a bill aimed at tackling food deserts. Deltona Republican Representative David Santiago is filing a bill that would help provide loans and grants to small grocery stores moving into food deserts.
So we're trying to lure them and help them go into areas where we want them to target. So there's a financial incentive there for entrepreneurs to tap into.
Santiago says it's a win-win for businesses and those in the state who are underserved. And he says it could lead to job creation, though he does admit the financial aspect of the bill could be a significant hurdle. Meanwhile, Fullwood says he's feeling good about his bill this year. He says it's been filed several times before and claims it's never gotten a no vote, but it hasn't been given enough priority to make its way through both chambers. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, and Regan McCarthy. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And please join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, helping donors make a difference through planned giving, putting donations to work so people with disabilities can too. On the web at abletrust.org. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.